This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. It is our last show of the year, actually. And if you've been listening regularly up till now, you'll know that we've been doing a best of series, the best of 2016. And if you haven't, do go back and check those out because they give you an insight into the year that was, at least as picked by two women who produced the show. So I don't know how wide-ranging it is, but I thought it was reasonable. Today, we're ending on the best of Dr. George Lee Park. Two, because of course, Dr. George is in every week, and it's just not enough to have one show of him. And I'm Lee Chui Lin, Tina Camellia, Health and Living Producers, also here.
So, we are touching a bit on tech and medicine. We are discussing issues surrounding reliability, for example, of tech in terms of accuracy and accessibility to information, issues surrounding healthcare and privacy, and whether technology is replacing doctor-patient time.
Bringing that all together was the story we did on period tracking apps, in which I think there was some surprise about how popular they were. So we asked Dr. Helena Lim, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist, as well as fertility specialist, to weigh in. Firstly, we wanted to know, how common is this app anyway?
How common are these apps? I mean, before these BBC articles, I must confess, I've never really thought about it or heard about it. But, you know, how many 200 million downloads?
See, I'm unsurprised. I'm unsurprised because I use one myself. Specifically, I use Clue, which is very good. And I find it very interesting because there are three women on the team, the Bigger Picture team that put the show together every day. And of the three, only one third use an app, and that one third is me.
So
it's actually strangely not
common
within my team.
Within your team.
That was sort of the dipstick test that I took. But what I wanted to know, Dr. Helena, is so people keep track of their cycles. Do people keep track of their cycles? Or do you still find people coming in and saying, oh, I don't know. I think I'm on time. I'm not sure, you know.
Well, I would say that probably about 10% of them are like this because probably I'm looking at a very specific group of women who is trying to get pregnant and couldn't get pregnant. So I think they may have gone into the internet to look for information. They would have had, friends who share with them, look, you know, there's an app there. You can actually track your menses and know exactly, you know, roughly figure out when you are ovulating and so forth. So I think the majority of women who comes through to my clinic would have had some sort of app, whether it's in Mandarin, whether it's in English or whatever languages.
Right, yeah. Okay. I mean, essentially, you have a different demographic of women who try to get pregnant. Of all these women, how many of them are so tech-savvy that they have these apps? And how sophisticated are these apps?
Okay. There are, I would say, about close to 80 to 90% of women who comes through my door would have these apps in their smartphone because I think smartphone is so easily available nowadays. So I think these apps are free most of the time. So I think most of them would have downloaded an app. So I think I would say about 80% of women would have had this kind of apps in their phone.
And Dr. Helena, I think you're really the only person who can answer this because you would see women who would have an app that would tell them when their fertile window is, but you can actually tell them because the question here is there's also the issue of accuracy, right? Because the apps, from what I understand, assume that we are all, I mean, they rely on us to put in our personal information,
absolutely.
But otherwise they assume that we are all running perfect 28-day cycles,
absolutely.
That we all ovulate on, you know, day whatever. So do you find that there is an accuracy there? Like when you compare and contrast on a woman's app, let's say it says her day of ovulation is, you know, today, August 19th. Do you find that there is, are they close? Are they getting there?
Well, if you assuming that you have 28 regular cycle, then I think 95% of women with regular menstrual cycle will ovulate at the same time. You're meaning that the accuracy is about 95%. But a lot of women actually don't have very regular cycle, especially those with polycystic ovary syndrome. They are really all over the place. So, and the app is actually, like you said, it's actually a retrospective kind of data, meaning that you key in the information, and sometimes these apps may have difficulty trying to figure out when is your fertile period because of the irregular cycle. So there are women who with very irregular cycle would have, you know, very, very prolonged window of fertility. So meaning that the app will tell them that your fertile window period could be up to 2 weeks.
Right.
So they come in and show me the app and say, look, I don't know what to do. Should I try naturally every day or should I, you know, try every 2 days or what should I do? Now, in this kind of scenario, I would tell them, look, you know, the app is not 100% accurate. It doesn't take away my clinical judgment, my clinical diagnosis or my investigation. So the way forward for me, for you, it would be having a scan by me to look at whether your follicles are growing and whether it has reached a certain size. And I'll send you home with some fertility kit, fertility urine test to see that whether you're ovulating. So my clinical judgment would have provide you a more accurate diagnosis of ovulation rather than the app.
The Olympics also happened this year, and how might that relate to a period tracker? Well, this happened.
One person who made the news, and has been making the news throughout the games actually because she's adorable, is Chinese swimmer Fu Yuanhui. But she made the news this week because she basically said that she was swimming, I think, on the second day of her period or the first day of her period, and that it hurt, and but that it wasn't an excuse for poor performance. Dr. Helena, what did you think of her kind of
statement?
Yeah, you know, coming out and talking about it.
Okay, yeah. In fact, I think most of us would understand that when you are having your period, your tummy is crampy, you feel lousy, you feel that you're always worried, especially for Fu Yuanhui, who is swimming. And yes, you're always worried that when you go into the water, whether your tampon is going to hold your period blood, whether you're going to leave a streak of blood as you swim.
Mm.
I think all this puts on certain stress and pressure to her. And when you are menstruating, really, your body is actually crampy, you're not feeling that well. And in fact, that significantly have put some stress on her and obviously her physical performances as well. So I would agree that it actually has some implication on the physical performance of the athletes when they are having their menses or even before they...
Well, I mean, that makes this app really applicable for many people because, you know, apart from actually working out which part of the cycle you are performing well, and then some people may actually be a little bit more grumpy or moody, probably premenstrual. I mean, that's you know...
Well documented.
Or, and in fact, the interesting thing was that when BBC actually compiled this report, they actually highlighted that an opera singer, the voice is completely changed whenever that's affected by hormonal change. Yes. And then so she will completely avoid any performances during this period of time. How true is that? I mean, is that really something that such app can help women to monitor their peak performance and that might be related to their work?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some reports on looking at studies that looks at female athletes and whether their performance is better pre-ovulation and post-ovulation. Well, we know that pre-ovulation, your body is high in estrogen, and after ovulation, your body is high in progesterone. So people are very interested to look at how estrogen and progesterone and how the balances actually
and different
enhance.
People will respond differently to those two hormones.
Yeah, absolutely. So they find that your peak performance is actually better when it comes to pre-ovulation. And after ovulation, your body your body temperature actually increases.
Right.
And then you'll find that there's actually higher, you feel more stressed. So therefore, PMS is the, you know, the symptoms that you may feel.
So your kind of body performance perhaps is it's not comparable to pre-ovulation.
That's right. Yeah,
so that will make it very suitable for people who actually, you know, work out that certain meetings can be kind of like, you know, arranged before their ovulation and things like that. So is that amazing how data, you know, can tell you something like that, and apps can do that.
Which led Dr. George then to question how men might also benefit from the information from these apps.
For men, I mean, I'm sure so many men will call in to kind of to actually verify what I'm going to say. Is that sometimes you can't work out why your partner is simply not happy, right? Okay, you can potentially blame it on cycle or something like that. But if you can share the apps and actually say these are the time that actually potentially I'm not happy because of hormonal situation, I think many men will find that, you know, know, quite a good app to appreciate that, you know, they will avoid certain time.
And like, certain activities, exactly. To irritate like, the
you
know, woman.
I really think with such app, if you share it with your partner, I think that will ensure a lot of harmony in the relationship. Come on, guys, give us a ring just to tell us whether, do you think if that's something that might be suitable for your relationship?
You are listening today to the Best of Health and Living 2016, our final episode concluding with the Best of Dr. George Lee, Part 2. If you missed Part 1, you can go and check that out on our website as well as our app. Up next, we find out more about bedside manners, HIV and smartphone addiction. You are listening today to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, together with Health and Living producer Tina Camellia. We are concluding our Best of Health and Living 2016 today with a look at the best of Dr. George Lee, our doctor in the house.
When it comes to bedside manners, it's more than just social niceties. In a medical setting, it turns out that it's something that can result in worse outcomes for the patient. But is it something you can teach or learn? Are medical students and junior doctors just learning from senior doctors who are just as tired and stressed out?
So we wanted to explore whether there was room for courtesy in the operating theatre, especially if it's an emergency. With long hours, how do you continue to put on a pleasant demeanour? What happens in inconvenient settings? How do people deal with mistakes? Well, Dr. Renu Rajan, upper GI and bariatric surgeon, joined Dr. George Lee for this. They shared some stories from the field.
I mean, you're talking two surgeons here. I mean, you know, and it's true that sometimes we're put into a situation where a decision we make in a split second may determine whether someone lives or someone die, especially when in the middle of doing an operation. I mean, I'm trying to, this is the real life experience here, which I'm going to talk about. I mean, when I was a student, well, actually not quite a student, when I was a registrar. Registrar is kind of like in the journey of your training to become a consultant. It's a six-year journey to be a urology registrar all the way to become. In my second year registrar, I was working in Hammersmith Hospital, worked for this particular doctor, very well-known doctor, however, taking on very complicated cases, and it's particularly to do with transplant. And I remember vividly that if the transplant is, if somebody who had multiple operations, then you would imagine that there's lots of adhesions within the abdomen. And this particular doctor wanted to take out a kidney. And, you know, one thing led to another, then a large artery, it's actually a large vein, was torn and the patient was bleeding. And under these circumstances, and this guy is supposed to be the calmest person you have to be, right? Okay. And then similar to this paper, and somebody dropped something, you know, a nurse dropped something. And he turned around and said, look, if you turn your back on me again, I'm going to kill you. In that sort of tone. I mean, I'm sure a lot of pop culture, Grey's Anatomy, that is a reflection of this. But in real life, it happens. But, you know, on one hand, the nurse obviously was taken back and then, you know, filed a complaint. And then on the other hand, you know, this was a life and death situation. So it's difficult, like you said, you know, sometimes the surgeon themselves are under stress and that's how the rudeness comes out. But however, is there a way around it? Was what we were put under the spotlight to do it. Because as two juniors helping this major, this surgeon, this prominent surgeon, we were asked to reflect on it. Because these days, which I'm going to talk about, because we are in academic worlds, and then these days the training is very, very different. And when we were asked what happened to make a statement, and then could this be avoided? And it's a very difficult thing to say, you know, could this be avoided? So was the surgeon particularly rude, or was he under stress? Was it acceptable? Was it not acceptable? It is all subjective. And, you know, that is the sort of situation that we're talking about here. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. On a slightly different take, I remember assisting one of my senior consultants about a couple of years back. And I remember prior to the surgery, he did mention to the nurse that I want the diathermy pad in a certain way so that the surgeon doesn't get electrocuted due to all these gadgets that we use in OT. And she kind of shrugged him off and said, yeah, you know, we know how to do our job kind of thing. And I remember he was pretty clear about his request. And half an hour into the surgery, you can imagine, zap,
okay,
he gets electrocuted. And, you know, what followed after that was a barrage of very interesting words. And, of course, she went on to cry and make a report. But then again, I don't know. I mean, looking back at that one incident, you know, maybe he could have toned it down, but he did mention it much early on that, look, you know, probably from a prior experience of being zapped as well, you know, he did say that the connection's a little loose, so make sure you put the diathermy pad in a certain way.
Mm.
And she didn't respect his orders, and the one that gets zapped is not her, but him. So, I mean, this is an operating theater scenario, and then it takes him, you know, it takes us, like you said, it's, we're not extra human. It takes us a couple of minutes to kind of regain. I mean, how does one react after getting electrocuted in OT and you have an open abdomen there and you're supposed to be thinking straight again within minutes to, you know, get back to what you're doing, which is saving lives?
Both doctors agreed something needs to change and action's being taken, but it's happening slowly. But there's hope.
I think, yes, to a certain extent, yeah, this study did, you know, does reflect a lot in real-life medical practice. Basically, it touched on a few components. It looked at the composite diagnostic scores and the composite procedural performance scores, which clearly showed a statistical significance in terms of, like, when they compared the group that was exposed to rudeness versus the group that wasn't exposed to rudeness. So this was a pretty good study, and I think the closest we've come to resembling real-life scenario.
Would you like to kind of highlight a little bit of a synopsis of this study? You know, so it was published in Pediatrics, right?
And then, yeah, it was. Yeah. I think it's a 2015, pretty decent study involving 24 groups, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, that's right. There were 24 teams, and they were in a training simulation that involved a preterm infant whose condition acutely deteriorated. And they were randomly assigned to either exposure to rudeness or exposure to, you know, just neutral comments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And after that, when they were evaluated by independent judges who assessed team performance, information sharing, help seeking, they found that, yeah, the team that had been exposed to rudeness actually had a drop of performance by more than 50%.
Right, okay. Right, were you surprised by that?
No, not really. I think, I mean, I'm sure, George, even you in your junior days, many years back, you know.
We're going to share some stories later, right?
Yes, for sure. You know, if we were to go back and have a flashback moment in time, I'm sure you would remember recollecting how, you know, your knees probably buckled and how you would, you know, shake for half an hour following a rude comment by maybe a senior or a consultant in the ward during ward rounds.
Indeed, they're vividly in our minds.
Yeah,
right?
it would take you a good half an hour to probably 2 hours, maybe even more, to kind of recollect yourself and gather composure and start doing your work again.
Sometime half a century.
Maybe, yes. And some of those comments actually stay with you for life.
Yeah.
But some people would argue that that's, you know, tough love, that the whole idea is, you know, they... Or at least I think that's the argument. I'm not a doctor myself. I'm not a proponent of tough love myself, so I wouldn't know. But from what I understand, you know, it's kind of like, well, you guys are going to be in tough working environments, so I have to be tough with you when I teach you. And if part of that is rudeness, then part of that is rudeness.
And get on with it. That's,
I mean,
sort
is,
of
is that how
right?
it is?
That is how it is, but I don't think that's how it should be. At least not most of the time. You know, if one or two occasion it kind of slips out, I think it's okay as long as you do damage control later on. Like, pull your junior or colleague aside and talk to them nicely, buy them coffee and explain why you had that lapse of inner judgment or that sort of moment in time. But I think generally there are other ways to go about it. Mm-hmm. I don't think we need to be part of that vicious cycle that was done onto us. I think you can be the change. Break that cycle and make a difference if you want it.
Coming back to Tech and Medicine, Jeff Sandu, BFM's Tech Maestro, joined us for a show a lot of people can relate to. What do you consider a phone addiction? Are there social and psychological impacts? You know, is its use affecting our quality of life or is it enhancing it? We started off by turning the question to both our guests. Do you think you're addicted to your phone?
Yeah, I am. I'm just checking my phone at the moment. I am actually checking my phone. And it's not that I'm not listening to what Lynn says, because if I wasn't listening, I wouldn't be able to address it. I think the change is that we're a lot more hungry
For information,
because it's easily accessible at the moment. You know, previously, you know, a lot of us, I'm sure, Dr. George, during your time, during your studies, you had
during
to go
my
to,
time.
Do, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
there
is,
true.
There
it is,
is
true. It
you,
is true.
You used to, you know, run to, you know, to places where, you know, you get this information, but it's all separate and
differently,
and it's very far away. You got to go to the library, and then from the library, you got to probably, you know, get back home. The distance, the duration. Right now, if I ask you a question and you have no idea what it is, it's only a Google Google search away, which is only about a millisecond before you get your answer.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, earlier on, you know, I was in university and I was teaching. I was telling them that in the old days, when you want to write a journal paper, you have to go to, you know, in Cambridge, there are 27 libraries, and each one of them actually kept different journals. And then in order to cycle from one to another to get a compiled article, it will take you about 4 weeks to do that. Now it'll take you 4 hours to write a paper. And the other thing is that I was raised in the era of snail mail, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, post office doesn't even need to exist. You know, like stamp is a kind of like an antiquity in many sense.
It's
right?
now
like
a collector's stamp.
Collecting stamps, right?
That's what it is.
I mean, so, you know, and then email is kind of like, you know, obviously is the true part of the core of our lives.
Yeah.
And therefore, is this really generating advancement for mankind, or is this really causing barriers in, is causing harm or good, is what I want to discuss.
It's interesting you mentioned email, because email is now also being discussed as a disruptive tool, because it's now invading your personal space, which is where you're supposed to have your downtime. But we're still connected with the phones because email is something that, you know, we expect to reply immediately. You know, we need to be connected immediately. Employees, they have, you know, like if I sent you, oh, did you check an email last night and it's only maybe 10 a.m. and you go like, no, I didn't check my email last night, and you feel like, oh, did I drop the ball here, because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't connected. So then you know, that's that pressure of like, I need to check my mail before I go to sleep, just so that, you know, everything is calm and peace as how it's supposed to be.
Talking about how personal choice in information consumption and connectedness regulates our smartphone behavior was also when we recognized the generation gap in our show.
I don't allow people to see when I've read their message because I refuse to...
I didn't even know that is possible.
Well, George, if you listen to Tech Talk on every Monday to Friday at 12...
All right, okay.
You would have known, to remove those blue ticks.
Okay, all right.
No, but I do it for that reason, because I don't want to be pressured into the instant reply. I need to be able to have that downtime. So I think a lot of it is personal choice, or if you're Dr. George Lee, maybe you just didn't know how to do it.
I mean, this... We're talking about somebody who didn't even know that watching DVD is a very old-fashioned thing, because people stream now. You didn't quite make fun of it, because Lynn kind of pointed out that it's like people still watch DVD.
I can't remember the last time I watched the DVD as well.
Okay, Jeff, you're really making me feel much
better.
We are
the same age, so this is not going to...
This is not helping, okay?
Dr. George then went on to try to defend why he has not won... but two phones.
I have actually got two phones. And I said, you are doubly addicted. Well, the thing is that I have two phones because I work for two different hospitals, and I just want to establish that which hospital calls me. In fact, they might as well be the old-fashioned Nokia, because, you know, these are... I mean, although they are smartphones, and, you know, just to kind of reflect that I can, you know, handle smartphone, the reality is that they might as well just be old-fashioned Nokia, because I simply take them to use as phone calls. So I don't think I'm addicted, because most of the time when I'm having kind of a boredom time, I'm struggling to find what can excite me on the web, because I don't have enough apps in there to kind of excite me. I previously was on Facebook, and then I found out that why was I using my iPhone to feed the food first before I feed myself? And I was thinking that I was kind of, it was more ego thing, that I was expecting those likes when I put on Facebook. And then suddenly I realized that I didn't like the person that I was portraying in the Facebook, and suddenly switch it off.
You have a very healthy relationship with social media.
Well,
no, you didn't get carried away, because you put a stop to it.
Oh, I it's actually my daughter put a stop to it. My daughter said, look, Dad, can we eat
How
now,
old is
please?
She? Yeah,
she's 14.
So
right?
does
okay.
she have a Facebook account?
No, she has no Facebook account. It's probably because my wife won't allow that. Right,
it's also because, I mean, young people are moving off of Facebook.
They're moving to Snapchat, which until today I still have no idea how Snapchat works.
But I love Snapchat.
Dr. George is just like, what's Snapchat?
So if you're wondering whether you might be a smartphone addict, Dr. George helpfully defines the parameters of addiction for us.
Normally, when somebody asks me about mobile phone, they usually just ask me, as a urologist, ask me about associations with infertility. How is it frying your balls, or how is it frying your head, right? Okay, because all these are the things that actually are affecting the health. But with all these datas coming out, with these addictions, definitions of addictions coming out, I think it actually has a certain medical relevance. Because in order to talk about something that's addictive, let's say you think about gambling, you think about alcohol, you think about drugs, then you need to think about tolerance. What is tolerance? Tolerance is basically that you need more to get high. So you have, like, say, you know, initially 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and then now you're building up more and more and more. You need, now, so on average, an adult spends 3.6 hours on the phone checking mails, which is quite worrying because this was a study that's done in the University of Derby. I think 3.6 hours is a long time.
Well, okay, I'm going to interrupt you there to turn to Jeff and ask, 3.6 hours, does that sound about right?
3.6 hours in a day?
I'm going to be honest, that sounds about right for me.
Oh, it's not for me. Definitely.
Not males.
A lot more for you?
A lot more for
me. Are you serious? Yeah. You have addiction problems.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you sound surprised.
So like for me, it's part of my work.
Well, that's argument, right? I mean, your excuse is that it's part of your work, but how much of that is your work? You know, let's say, you know, how much of your Facebook looking at certain videos, is that defined as your work, you know, research or not? It's just like me going on a conference. Is that work or not, right?
But I think the biggest thing is to understand, like, you know, the level, right? So addiction is when you're doing it something excessively, I guess, right?
So who defines excessively is a good point, right? Yeah. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing that you need to have is that high. So you need to get reward. So by doing that, it will... So when you see those likes on a Facebook, is that giving you that high, right? The third thing that we need to find out is withdrawal. So if you lose your phone, are you going to know bananas, right? Okay, Jeff, we are really doing therapy on you today.
No. Right? So just to budge in, if I lose my phone, everything is still backed up somewhere. It's just a matter of getting a new phone, and within a few minutes,
listen to yourself there.
But it's I'm not addicted. It's like it's the ease of doing things.
Yeah. Jeff, the first step to getting help is admitting you have a problem.
That's right. It's okay. We will do this therapy on air. And the last thing is that you need to potentially identify harmful impact it has on your life. So those are the four things: tolerance, the reward, the withdrawal, and also negative impact on your life.
And in case you were listening to all this and thinking that Jeff seems like kind of an addict, you're not alone. We have Joe on the line. Good afternoon, Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. Yeah, actually, I just want to say, Jeff, I mean, like, I'm going to admit it, you're addicted.
Yes, that's great.
And finally, since we are still in the month of December and World AIDS Day fell on December 1st, our resident geneticist, Dr. Arif Anwar, came in for a very insightful discussion into the hope for a cure for HIV via genetics. But first, the vindication of the man long thought to be patient zero.
Most viruses have an animal reservoir. They kind of develop in animals, and when you have close proximity to animals, they jump over. So there is a virus called SIV, which is simian, monkey, immunodeficiency virus. And that virus, essentially, the theory is that it was basically, it could only infect monkeys, and it could not cross into humans. And this is not in this news story, but I'm going back to my basic virology now from 20 years ago. But essentially what happened was that the thoughts are that certain tribes in Africa would eat the brains of these monkeys.
Oh, okay.
And
a
that
bit
was
like mad cow disease, kind of like
a bit like mad cow disease, a bit like even how flu crosses from avian to human. So that's the theory, the real patient zero, let's not call them him or her a patient. It was a monkey somewhere, or somebody in Africa who acquired that virus.
Why is this identification of patient individual zero? I don't know what the word is anymore, but why is this identification so important?
Well, it's really, really important. Any disease, when it spreads, knowing where it came from gives you clues in terms of how it transmits, how can you control it, what are the measures that can be put in place to control it. I mean, the reason why this poor guy got, and he's passed away, you know, got a lot of bad press and notorious image is because, you know, he was thought to be the person who first sparked off the spread of HIV in North America. But, you know, at the end of the day, Knowing the root of the disease is very important because you could use that initially during an infection. I mean, we saw it, for example, with Zika, mm-hmm. right, recently, and we've seen it in the past with, for example, with SARS. You know, very, very important to trace back how it spread. Particularly also, you know, if you look at recently also with avian flu, you're tracing it back as a way to control it and also to understand how it spreads.
I agree with you that origin of how this was transmitted was very important, and where did it come from was very important, because that potentially can open up clues to how to solve the problem. Why did it take so long? I mean, this was 1984. You know, why did it take so long to get the genetic analysis to now kind of like declare that he's innocent after all?
Well, the reason why it's taken so long is initially he was believed to be patient zero. And what's happened is a new scientist has gone back and sequenced more of the viruses from individuals who were downstream of that person, let's use that word, downstream of that person, and also gone back to that person as well and gathered more evidence. Mm-hmm. And it looks like when they've looked at other individuals in North America who were also HIV positive and who've also passed away, that those other individuals look like they're further down the tree.
Right.
Right? So he isn't the one who is the big, you know, if you imagine, it's not really a tree. You know, most epidemiologists draw it like a
river with tributaries?
That's a great example. A river with tributaries. So the point at which the river starts is patient zero. And what they found is by looking at other individuals, that this individual is not at the root of the river. Mm-hmm. He's a bit further down. So he is in patient zero. They're shifting the blame to somebody else. I mean, blame is the wrong word. I think it's
focus.
Yeah,
I guess,
well, in some ways. I mean, there's nothing you can do. I mean, it's historical.
Some people have thankfully had a functional cure since patient zero, of course. Dr. Arif weighed in on the Berlin patient and throws in a Donald Trump reference to boot.
The way that works is, and if you imagine, and I'm going to try and be topical and use a Donald Trump analogy.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so, which is quite a serious one. So if you imagine, if you watch movies where there's like a nuclear war about to happen, right? There's like two guys and they both have a key and they both have to turn it at the same time, mm-hmm. right? And otherwise it doesn't work. That's the way HIV enters cells. HIV needs two keys. Let's use the word keys. They use two receptors. So it needs two keys to enter the cell. Some individuals, in fact, 1% of Caucasians, have a natural mutation in one of the co-receptors, one of the keys. So HIV will attach to one of the keys to try and get into this inside the cell. But because the key doesn't recognize the other key, because it's a bit different, and it just can't fit into that. It doesn't recognize it. So it can't even enter the cell. So it makes that individual immune to HIV. No matter what, that person will not get infected with HIV because they have a mutation in one of the co-receptors, which makes the key look different, and the virus just doesn't recognize it, and it can't go into the cell.
And then it just dies.
Sorry?
And then it dies?
Well, the virus, I mean, HIV is an extremely frail virus, right? Thank God. It cannot survive for any period of time outside, you know, when exposed to air. It needs to be inside a living environment. If it can't enter a cell, it can't do anything itself. It's like the ultimate bad guest, you know, at your house. This guest cannot do anything. It will take everything from you. It needs everything from you. It can't do anything by itself. So it dies.
As far as the holy grail of a cure goes, Dr. Arif thinks the answer may lie here.
This is where this very exciting technology called CRISPR comes in. There is a new technology, which has only been around for 3 or 4 years, since 2012. And CRISPR is a true revolution. And it falls under an umbrella of technologies called genome editing. Mm-hmm. For the very first time, humans, we've developed, and this came out of California, you know, UC Berkeley, and for the very first time, scientists have the capability to go in and change at DNA level, very, very precisely, which is very important, right? That the DNA within a cell. So, for example, what they're working on right now is several ways to cure HIV. One way to cure HIV is exactly this co-receptor thing. If you could generate lots of cells that had that mutation, right? The trick is, how do you get it to the point whereby there's enough of them within a human so that they're all going to be like that? You see what I mean? So, you know, if you have a glass of milk, right? So imagine all the little milk particles, they're all white. You need to change every single one of those back to a different color, back to black. It's not a trivial thing to do because, you know, there are hundreds of billions of white cells, and there are 10 trillion other cells within a human body, right? And so all you'd have to change all the T cells. So it's not a simple thing to cure.
For any residual confusion, Dr. Arif also lays down the life cycle of the virus and how that might relate to treatment.
So there are several, you're right, George, there are several tiers at which you could target this. One way, one thing which is already being done is curing people who already have HIV, cutting out the virus from inside human cells, and then the cell repairs itself, and that virus is gone. Then, the other point is, going back to the co-receptor, the two key thing, if you could develop a situation whereby enough cells could be made to have that advantageous mutation, then you could have a pseudo-vaccine, right? It means that you'd be protected from it. So individuals who were HIV negative, you could have a pseudo-vaccine, which would basically, like having a vaccine for hepatitis B or tuberculosis.
Finally, to end on an optimistic note.
Well, I mean, we've been kind of like highlighting this topic for the last, how many years? It's like 7 or 8 years. I mean, I really think every time, you know, we get the same questions. Is there ever going to be a cure? You know, that's the reason why I use the word elusive, kind of like a quest. Today, you know, it's eye-opening, although I must say some of the information that I hear it may be a little bit complex, and then it just sounded a bit too good to be true and that sort of thing. However, it actually just looking at a disease eradication in the different angle, which I am very excited. And I really think that for many years, people like Adiba has worked extremely hard in order to suppress that taboo. And then that, in many ways, has been achieved. And then also begin to get people to accept that it's not a death sentence, that the antiviral therapy is treating this as a chronic disease. However, I think this will bring some glimmer of hope for many sufferers, and also prevention in the future. Arif, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I to give you some history, I did my PhD 23 years ago on actually virology. That was my original profession. So I was studying virus. I was studying pox virus. It's an old virus that's already been addressed and cured, and there is a vaccine which is very effective for it. And I remember going to a virology meeting where they were talking about the breakout of mad cow disease in the UK in the mid-90s. And there's a whole bunch of, there's 1,000 people who were virologists, and you could have heard a pin drop in that room. It was a very depressing, scary time. There was real talk of it going out of control. And back then also, there was a great deal of negativity about HIV. There was a great deal of negativity in terms of, you know, it could be 50 years. Or maybe, you know, you can Google this. There are scientists who are extremely well qualified who've said in the past that there may never be a cure for HIV. I think to follow on from what George said, for really, really, there is now real light at the end of the tunnel. That there are reasons to be truly optimistic and positive, that we have turned the corner as a global community, and there is a realistic possibility that a cure is not next year, but it's something that there is now real steps being made towards a cure. And I think that's incredibly encouraging. And for anyone who knows someone or is, you know, who has HIV or is suffering from it, real optimism. But again, like any medical research, it takes time to make sure it's right, to make sure it's tested and it's effective. So it's still a number of years away, but we've turned the corner.
And that is it for the year. We are done with 2016. Let us know your pick. What were your favorite shows? What weren't? What do you want us to cover next year? Also, don't forget to browse our podcasts. Again, that's bfm.my. But you can also, and I've been encouraging you to do so for a little while, if you haven't listened, that's okay. But the BFM app is very cool. It allows you to personalize your own BFM experience. It allows you to listen only to Health and Living if perhaps that's what you want. I'm not saying it has to be, but perhaps. And regardless, we'd like to hear from you. Email us at biggerpicture@bfm.my. And in the meantime, have a very happy New Year celebration and we'll see you in 2017. This is Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.